Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was curated by First Nations curator Tony Birch and was proudly supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Thank you very much for joining us. My name's Tony Birch. I'm hosting this session on Frontier Fictions. I'll formally introduce our two guests in a moment. Before we start, just the minor housekeeping issue is the telephone issue. So if you have a phone, please ensure that it is turned off. And if you think it's not turned off, just check now. You know, go through your pockets. Secondly, of course, is that after the session today, our guests will be signing copies of their books. You'll go through here where the readings have set up a book room where there's a signing table so you can have a chat to both of our authors. And also, as part of the session today, we will also ensure that we have time for questions. So at about 15 minutes beforehand, we'll ensure that the roving mic finds you. The only thing that we ask with the questions is that they are questions and that they're relatively succinct. If you want to tell Fiona or Paul a story about your family experience, you can do that at the signing table. But, of course, the other important issue is to ensure that we recognise the country that we're on and that we pay great respects to the traditional owners of the land on which this event is taking place. So it is always a privilege for me to pay due respect to the Wurundjeri people of the Greater Kulin Nation and to ensure that we hold a conversation that is generous and inclusive and respectful in giving recognition to traditional owners, and that we extend that respect, of course, to Wurundjeri elders, past and present. We extend that again to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the audience today. But I want to add to that is a very important Wurundjeri woman, a friend of mine, Aunty Joy Murphy, would say if she were here, we want to extend that to everyone here and to your families, to your communities, and wherever it is that you come from, either within Australia or originally in other parts of the world. So that's very important to us. I'm here to talk about two remarkable books. One by Fiona McFarlane, The Sun Walks Down. Even the title is beautifully poetic. And the other, Jesus Town by Paul Daly. They are novels that I think have great crossover appeal in the sense of these novels weave stories that I think speak quite proactively to each other. They are novels that address issues that should be of concern to all of us in Australia in regard to, I suppose, what we might consider the legacies of colonialism that we all have to deal with. What I'm going to do is to give a formal introduction to both writers, and then after that I'm going to ask both writers to give just a very short synopsis of their work for anyone who hasn't read their work or this work. And then I'm going to ask both of the writers to read an extract from their books, which will give us a really good context to enjoy this conversation. So Fiona McFarlane is the author of the novel The Night Guest, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Literary Award, and a collection of short stories, The High Places, which is one of the great short story collections I've ever read, which won the International Dylan Thomas Prize. Her short fiction has been published in the New Yorker, Best Australian Stories, Zoetrope, all story. Born in Sydney, Fiona teaches creative writing at the University of California, Berkeley. She's a lucky person to be doing that. Paul Daly is a friend of mine. I know we do this sometimes, Paul and I. He is unfortunately a Collingwood supporter. Paul Daly is the author and journalist for The Guardian newspaper, where he writes about Australian history and national identity. And Paul writes regularly for The Guardian and really important material. His books have been shortlisted for major Australian awards. He has won numerous journalism prizes, including Walkley Awards for Indigenous and Investigative Journalism. His latest novel, Jesus Town, is about frontier violence, anthropology, and cultural theft. Okay. So, as I said, what we're going to do is begin by getting you to pitch your novels to the audience. And I'll start with you, Paul. If you could just tell our audience what your novel is about.
Sure. Thanks, Tony. And thanks, Fiona. And thanks, everyone, for coming. It's great to be here. Jesus Town is a story about three generations of an Indigenous family and also a white Australian family and how they connect through anthropology in a remote former mission town in northern Australia, somewhere north of the Savannah line, I suppose, between Broome and Cairns, and how they connect through anthropology. There are two white protagonists. One is a fellow called Nathaniel Renmark, who was a famed anthropologist whose fame really hinged on a notion that he saved a black community from massacre. And of course, white Australian history is full of white saviour tropes. The other protagonist is his grandson, Patrick Renmark, who is a popular historian who deals in absolutes of good and bad, black and white. He writes a lot of books about white-hatted Anzacs, for example. Anyway, he finds himself in need of a sanctuary, and for reasons that unfold in the book, his life becomes chaotic and he ends up in Jesus Town trying to sort out the truth about his grandfather, Nathaniel, and what he may or may not have done.
Thank you, Paul. That's a pretty good summary.
Thanks.
So you go, Fiona.
Sure. Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Paul. Thank you, everyone, so much for being here. The Sun Walks Down is set in the September of 1883. It is set in the Flinders Ranges in South Australia, in a small invented town called Fairley. There are various things going on in this town. One of them is that pretty recently the town was established because people felt that they could probably grow wheat in the desert. And so they're giving that a go. That has, you know, that has followed on years of pastoral occupation of the land, which follows from the dispossession of the Adnyamatna and Nakana people. This town is experiencing strange sunsets at the moment. That's why it's called The Sun Walks Down. And the whole novel kicks off with that sort of trope of Australian literature and art and culture, the white child lost in the wilderness. So the novel takes place over 1 week, and we get to watch this town, the family of the little boy, the six-year-old boy who goes missing, and the town and various visitors looking for this boy. And in the course of that week, we get to encounter a whole lot of different characters, a newlywed who is rather upset that her policeman husband has been sent out on the search for the boy. We encounter Afghan cameleers, we encounter Aboriginal trackers, we encounter artists, a bunch of artists behaving very badly. and we really get to know this community and their relationship with each other and with this land that they're all interacting with in really, really different ways.
Thank you. So as I said, so what I'll do now is ask both writers are invited by Fridays to read an excerpt from the novel. So again, are you happy to go first, Paul?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
Just to set it up, my popular historian Patrick has just arrived in Jesustown, and he's been met by a fellow called Jericho Bakerman. Jericho is one of the First Nations leaders in Jesustown, and he happens to be a real credible historian as opposed to the popular type of historian that Patrick is. Anyway, they have history, and they don't particularly like each other. The book is told in two first-person voices. One of them is Patrick's, and the other is the voice of his grandfather. But this is Patrick here. They're in the Hilux together, and they're heading into Jesustown. I say, "Jericho, I don't mean to be rude." Jericho interrupts. "I just know that your next word is going to be but. However, well, no, actually, it's a serious question, and I'm genuinely interested in the answer. It's just that there seems to be almost as much rubbish about as when I was a kid." Jericho says, "Fair enough, bro. The truth is, my people have never totally understood white man's rubbish. We've never come to deal with it properly. A legacy of colonialism, you know. You see, we'll catch a fish, cook him, eat him, then we'll leave his bones in the fire. But you people, well, you pay someone to catch him, someone else to cook him and serve him to you in white cardboard. Then you go and eat him and you leave the container for the rubbish man. What you see here is white man's rubbish. Blame the missionaries if you like. Blame Macca, the prick in the takeaway, who gives us thick arteries and diabetes with his chips and chicken salt. But don't blame us black fellas for white fella rubbish. Ah, the Marxist colonial deconstruction of the waste problem in a black community. I hear my mother say, if you can't say anything nice, I remain silent." Jericho works the silence with a deep sigh. He says, "I knew you wouldn't understand. You people never get it when I explain white rubbish." The road dips suddenly, disclosing a long, flat valley. Most of it is occupied by a well-tended Australian rules oval, dusty but with crisp white lines marking off boundary squares and semicircles. I remember this. The footy ground, always the heart and the pride of the place, and home of the Jesustown Sea Eagles. Something that hasn't changed. Men and women of all ages, teenagers and children, mostly unshod, are playing kick to kick. Just about everyone played for one of the J-Town Sea Eagles teams. Now, among this mob are members of the team proper in their brown and yellow striped guernseys. Somehow, they manage what looks like a training session amid the chaos. They zigzag between orange witches' hats, stab and hand pass. They trash talk, laugh, backslap, trade high fives, mock tackle. They whistle and call for the footy. I say, "Still the religion, I see, Jericho." Jericho says, "Bigger than ever. Once the mission went, footy moved in on Christianity. So it's traditional beliefs, then Aussie rules, Islam and Jesus. There's no church here anymore, right?" "Correct, but Jesus is still number three. Jesus Mareko, that is, centre half back. Scouts have been eyeing him." "Seriously, you've got a Jesus on the team?" "Two. J-Town's full of Jesuses." "Makes sense, right?" "Not really, given there's no church and that no one cares about Christianity anymore." "I didn't say nobody cared. What I'm saying is it's still part of the mix. It's complex and beautifully simple." "I see. Good. You still follow the game?" "No. English Premier League. Chelsea." "Blue Bloods. Pity. You used to love it. We were surprised how well you could play back then when you were a kid. Pretty handy small forward you were, and you could jump. Never as good as you though, Jericho, and probably too old, too unfit, even for kick to kick now." Jericho eyes me up and down. He's noting my paunch. "Nothing a bit of boot camp and bush tucker wouldn't fix," he says. I let this go too, even though in the course of a short drive, he's criticised my wardrobe, my intellect, and now he's fat-shamed me. And it goes on from there.
Thank you, Paul. So, Fiona, we'll hear from you. Thank you.
I'm going to read from the very beginning of the novel. "The boy met a god by the hollow tree. 'Go away,' said the boy, and the god, formless, passed on in the direction of the red hill. Then the boy was free to hunt in the scrub for roosting hens. When he came upon the hens, they flapped up as if they could fly, and he gathered their eggs in a basket. The boy was 6 years old and thin, with a vivid, pointed face. He wasn't pale exactly, his skin browned in the sun, but the visible veins at his wrists and ears suggested a delicacy that the people he knew associated with pale children. There was so little of him. When his mother held him, his heart felt near. Light hair lifting in the briefest wind, and not so delicate, in fact, a strong boy, a good runner. The name people called him was Denny, and he answered to it. The boy was gentle as he settled the eggs in the basket. Then his mother wanted him close. He knew this, even though she hadn't called his name. Nobody had ever told him about his mother's deafness. She was simply his mother, which meant she heard little and spoke less. But the boy knew when she wanted him to go to her. She had finished hanging the sheets on the line behind the house, and the boy went to give her the basket of eggs. She took it, bent down to him, and pressed her face against his neck. Today she belonged to him entirely. All his sisters were at a wedding in town, and his father was out planting parsnips. The boy and his mam were alone and loving among the sheets. Then, quick as a blink, she straightened, turned her back, and went into the house, which always ate her up. The boy, following, wanted to help her churn the butter, but she made him put his boots on. She laced them tight, and she sent him out with a sack to gather grass and bark and twigs. He liked to collect things for the fire, and he liked to please her. The black dog, Mopsy, woke from her nap in the sun and looked as if she might come with him, but she heard Mam start the butter churn and went to supervise that instead. The boy walked away from the red hill, although it was from behind the hill that his sisters would come home from town. The country he walked into was red and brown, desert country, but there was a haze of green over the top of it because it was spring. At this time of day, the surrounding hills were white and yellow and green. A shrub scratched the boy's shin, and he followed for a while the deep course of a dry creek. He kneeled on its stony bed and saw ants carrying a large dead fly. The word that came to him was housebound, because he'd heard his mother use that word about Mrs. Bauman, who had large eyes like a fly and clean, folded hands, and sat in a chair with wheels on it, as if she had neat grey wings tucked behind her. But the boy didn't think of Mrs. Bauman exactly. The word housebound just dropped into the boy and went away again. He rounded a curve in the creek and surprised a kangaroo. He knew the story of the kangaroo. Once upon a time, it argued about food with its cousin, the wallaroo, so now it stayed here on the dry, flat plain while the wallaroo lived up in the hills. The boy's heart was big with sorrow for the kangaroo, which crouched very still and looked at him. It seemed to be waiting for something to happen. Then it turned and flew from the creek bed, and the boy climbed out to follow it for its dung, which also burned. Really, he followed it because it was fast, because the boy was also waiting for something to happen. Because he was 6 years old. Soon things would happen. Men would call his name in the night. There would be blood on a handkerchief and fire on the red hill. The boy looked north and saw a high, dark wall over the ranges. The wall was moving towards him. It was made of dust, and when the dust reached him, it hid the sun. The sun was there. The boy could see it through his narrowed eyes, but it was brown now and silly, only as bright as a lamp or the moon. The dust rolled down from the north in secret colours, very soft, until the wind came up behind it. Then it stung. The boy held the sack across his face as his father had taught him to do when the dust storms came, and he turned around and began to walk, and that's how he got lost, trying to walk home in the dust. When the storm had passed, his mother went out into the yard and spat red onto the red ground. She looked for him in the direction he had gone and saw no sign. Thank you.
Thanks to both of you. It's really apt reading, Fiona, for me to for my first question, which will be for both of you, but to you initially. I'm really interested in the idea of alienation in this novel. And, yeah, there are various ways that we can think about it. And one that comes to mind is, from the Aboriginal perspective, that famous saying, Aboriginal people eventually becoming aliens in our own land. But one of the, I think, two aspects of haunting in the book very early on, And they're written in a very subtle and nuanced way, but more powerful because of that. So when Denny disappears, he literally vanishes into the dust, not into thin air, but thick air. But one moment he's there and then he's gone. And it shows how precarious a person's place in country can be. And then there is a remarkable piece of writing which says, when he doesn't come home, she, Denny's mum, goes out into the yard and calls his name, making an effort to raise him. When she calls her son's name, she looks to see if anything moves in an answering way. It's so wonderfully poetic. So I found both of those passages haunting in how quickly the boy vanishes and the fear of his mother, of her own voice being suffocated or disappearing. So I suppose for me, the first question for you is, in regard to alienation, is it the outsiders who are alien or is it the land that is alien to them? Because they seem to have a strong hold on the home or the homestead, and then immediately when they have to exist beyond the boundaries of the safety of home, their relationship or their tenure is just evaporates so quickly.
Yeah, thank you. What a wonderful question. I think what I really wanted to do in the book was explore the ways in which that is different for different people and in different ways. One of the sources of the book for me was thinking about the cultural narrative of the lost child and the way that it casts country, as particularly in the 19th century, as malicious or sinister or frightening or scary or dangerous. And there are so many encounters with that kind of depiction of the land that we encounter in Australian literature and in Australian art and in film and, you know, Picnic at Hanging Rock and, you know, all of these stories that we encounter all of the time. One of the things that struck me was that lost child stories usually do disappear a child early on and then rejoin that child, whether living or dead, by the time we reach the end of the story. And it was really important to me that we stay with Denny throughout his entire experience in the desert. Every character around him is having their own complicated relationship with this place. I don't know how many of you have been to the Flinders Ranges, but it is a truly extraordinary place. I think it is, I mean, one of the most remarkable things about it is that it is the only place in the world that you can view 350 million years of continuous geological history. And also the history of First Nations resistance in the Flinders is also just, you know, it's fascinating. It's complicated. The relationship of the invaders, the settlers to that land, the relationship of the traditional custodians to that land, nothing about it is sort of simple. So I wanted to explore not just a sense that there's alienation, there's one kind of alienation, but that there are multiple kinds of alienation. Mm-hmm. And for a little boy like Denny, who's never lived anywhere else, he's trying to make sense of the landscape that he has grown up in and become lost in. But then we have a character like Billy's father's hired hand, Denny's father's hired hand, Billy, who is a Yadliya Wada man and has grown up in this place as a child himself. There are two, that's just the beginning of two different ways that the novel is interested in thinking about what it means to be alienated from or to claim or to feel at home in a place that has itself been so unsettled.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the other points that comes out in relationship to this and the disappearance of the boy, it's also, and know this in sort of history as well as in fiction, an inability of the British, of the invader settler society, to recognise their own inabilities or their own failures. So they can actually revert to superstition. So they almost revert to, so they're Christian, nominally Christian, but they revert to very superstitious thoughts to justify what's going wrong. So it's interesting that we get a quote, for instance, that there are strangers out there in the desert, which is, you know, natives, hawkers, swagmen, teamsters, Chinese labourers and Afghans. So everyone is other who's out there, and which I think is interesting, again, because you have this tenuous hold on a place and what's beyond, you know, this great expanse of these others who you can't trust. And there's a lovely quote you say, George, one of the farmers, is, for instance, when he finds his plans disrupted, even by a natural event like rain, he blames Aboriginal people. So if it's not raining, it must be the blackfellow's fault. So the other issue that struck me then, and this is again in relationship to their inability to find the boy without having black track or Aboriginal knowledge, it's a refusal to, or an inability to accept their own place in place, that they are, in a sense, intellectually and culturally inferior in this place. So they blame all these people for what's going wrong, but they don't look in the mirror.
Yeah, they're completely ill-equipped for where they are and what they're doing there. But it's not their fault. Yeah.
Yeah. Paul, you have a alienation in your novel, and it's the protagonist. I think he, at one stage, I thought he's having his own waking fright moment when he's getting fried chicken with chicken salt. And, yeah, what is this concoction? What I'm interested in here is, so our protagonist, Patrick, is an alien in every sense. He has suffered the loss of a child. His wife doesn't want him anymore. His lover doesn't want him anymore. His self-worth is almost gone. He doesn't like his physical appearance. There's not much about himself he likes anymore, except that he sells a lot of books. And his memories of Jesus Town, so he's in London, on the other side of the world from which he visited to visit his grandfather as a teenager and has a very specific and violent memory of. Why does he go back there? Why is that the place when he's in a situation of desperation, but has quite, I suppose, troublesome memories of Jesus Town? Why does he go there? Other than in the, we have that sense, okay, this is part of writing this book, but psychologically and emotionally, why is he drawn to go back there?
Well, his memory of the place is that it's hostile territory, that he went there to, at the behest of his father, to check on his grandfather, the anthropologist who'd sort of gone quite mad when he was a kid, and, you know, he was estranged from Patrick's own father. So Patrick would go to see the grandfather to check on him, and it turned into a kind of good and bad experience for him. On the one hand, he had a connection with Jericho and his twin sisters. It was difficult with Jericho, but he had a real bond with Tamar, Jericho's twin sister, who was around about the same age. There was a frisson of sorts. So it's very mixed for him emotionally. Something terrible happens with his grandfather there. There's an act of violence, and Patrick flees as sort of a 16, 17-year-old, and he ends up on the other side of the world as a, you know, very successful, popular historian, you know, feeding the Anzac myth and selling a lot more books than me, I must say. He's doing very well, but his life is turned upside down in London. Something happens, which means he has nowhere to go. He has a long-standing gig, which he's kind of kept, you know, putting to the back of his mind, to go and write the story of his famous grandfather, who every historian in Australia really wants to write, because it's fascinating. He's the guy who saved the people. He ends up back there. He's running away. He's kind of drug-addled. He's drinking a lot. He's self-medicating, really. He doesn't really know if he wants to live or die, and he's got no intention of writing this book, but it's really the only place he can go, and he ends up there. And strangely, the place that might, in memory, seem really hostile to him ends up as a sanctuary. It's somewhere where he finds some security, and he actually finds the space to think about his life and to figure out whether he does want to live or die. And it's no kind of spoiler to say that's slightly unresolved.
I want to talk about this in relationship, I suppose, the relationship between fiction and knowledge. And I'll come back to Fiona because I'm really interested in the relationship between Billy and his white friends in some ways. But Paul, firstly to you, so he's a populist historian who sells lots of copies of big fat books. I was thinking of a particular Australian writer, but I'll ask you about that off stage. who played a bit of rugby, I think.
There's more than one.
Yeah. But in my colloquial note-taking, I said he's ultimately a bullshit artist. So he says himself, he's painting a picture of John Batman. So this is on this place, on Wurundjeri country. And when he wants to write about John Batman, he's painting a picture as a benevolent treaty maker rather than a syphilitic grifter or hunter-killer. So you said that could be interpretation, but clearly you're focusing on the light. So clearly what I think I really enjoy about this is that he's someone who self-consciously writes these nationalist myths of success or benevolence at worst, but it is going back to Jesus' town where he finds truth, and in some ways a horrific truth. So the journey is not just about, I suppose, a personal recovery. He understands what truth means by going back to Jesus' town and all the difficulty that entails.
Yeah, he does come to understand truth about himself and about his family. There is a revelation in it about his family and who they might be. But I think Patrick has always known that he's been dishonest in the way he cherry picks history. You know, he saw the writing on the wall. He tried to become, well, he got a PhD somehow, I don't know how, in history, but beyond
an honorary,
that. Sorry?
An honorary PhD.
Yeah, it could have been. There's a few of them. he's one of those guys. He was walking through the airport and he went into the bookshop and he saw the shelf that said history, and it was books by white blokes about white blokes with guns, right? And that's where the money was, and that's what he went for. His Lachlan Macquarie was a benevolent guy. You know, he didn't oversee massacres happen. His Batman was not the guy who was involved in hunting parties in Tasmania, and who supposedly, you know, traded the whole of this place for some flour and axe heads. You know, it is a book about how history is written and who gets to write it too. And Patrick could write whatever history he wanted, and he realised that the history he was writing was marketable and he was making money, but he was also empty. He was he was bereft.
Yeah. Yeah. And you, though, as Paul Daly, the journalist and writer, these big, fat, mythologised books, do you see them, other than our envy of not selling a lot of books, or as many, do you see them as problematic? Is the way that they construct Australia, considering they're so popular and so widely read?
I think, you know, there's degrees of it. I think some of them do a really good job. I think some of them absolutely do reduce Australian history to its basics and overlook, you know, all sorts of other stories. I mean, one of the things that got me into this space in the first place was a book I wrote a long time ago about Australians in the First World War in Palestine, and it crescendoed with a massacre, the Australian Light Horse massacring all the men, actually some of them were boys, aged over 16 in an Arab village and in a nearby Bedouin village. And I published this book, and then people started writing to me saying, why do you think it was that these Australians felt so able to massacre these people? They felt so sort of conversant in their hatred towards towards the other. And of course, that got me onto the question of frontier conflict and frontier war in Australia, which I started writing about. But I think a whole lot of First Nations writers and artists and dramaturgs in Australia have been leading the way on these other stories for a long time. And I think the tide is changing, and I'm really pleased to see that more and more people are writing stories about the frontier and dispossession, and how perhaps that is the true foundation of the Australian nation as we got it in 1901, as opposed to the other stories that Australia has clung to about the genesis of nationhood, not least 1915 in Gallipoli.
Thank you. One of the things that Fiona, I think that you do so well is the way that you convey the tension in relationship between Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people, and that feigned difference, which is employed so well. So Billy is an Aboriginal worker on a white farm, and he has a friendship with one of the white farmers, Matthew. And what Fiona does in the book is to show how Billy has to limit himself or contain himself so that him and Matthew play wrestle, but he makes sure he can't win. He can't win that fight, even though it's not, or becomes a much more serious fight at another point. That to win, to play is okay, but to win would be problematic. That extends to Billy's a great cricket player, and that extends even to when Billy's giving instruction of how to bowl better. He has to be careful how he instructs. He has to be careful how he imparts what is, in a sense, well, superior knowledge. If we extend that to issues of country and finding so-called black trackers to search for Denny, Aboriginal people who have such an important sense of knowledge of place and activity is that the way of explaining themselves to white people have to be done in a very particular way. So it's almost that they can't be seen to stepping above their station. They're very self-conscious of those relationships. Can you talk to that?
Sure. Well, Billy, I mean, just to give a little bit more information about Billy, he was a child when the first kind of pastoralists came to the Flinders, and was adopted by a man who's actually based on a real historical figure, the son of an earl who began a sheep and cattle station in the Flinders, and died at a young age trying to cross through a flooding river by horseback. Sort of thinking again about that sense of what the Europeans felt they were capable of doing on country that wasn't their own and was so unlike anything they'd encountered before, but that they were determined to master in some way. And Billy is taken under the wing of Henry Axum, in part because he's an excellent sportsman. He is a very good cricketer. He's trained as a cricketer. And Henry is something of an eccentric sort of a performative eccentric who likes collecting eccentric things. He makes collections of things he considers out of the ordinary and worthy of conversation. And Billy becomes one of those things in his collection. He has other things, like he builds a Greek temple in the middle of the Flinders. He plants a garden with only biblical plants. He has this enormous thing called an orchestrion installed in the house that plays sort of martial music. And Billy, he gets him sort of kitted up as a child in a full, perfectly tailored cricket uniform and sort of trots him out whenever he has guests. And he has, you know, he is, and as a result, Billy is sort of existing in this strange place in between his extraordinary ability at cricket and his love of his physical skill and all of the ways in which he has to be careful about his extraordinariness, that he can never, he can never proclaim it, he can never rely on it, he can it's dangerous for him to be extraordinary in any way. By the time we meet him, he's in his 50s, his cricketing days are behind him, in part because he's so good that the station team and the town team, neither of them will allow him to play on their teams because he's so much better than everyone else that it seems unfair. So his cricketing days are behind him. He is, I mean, one of the arcs of the whole novel is Billy's participation in the search for Denny and the ways in which, I suppose, it forces him to confront the specific kinds of dispossession that he has been subjected to by, you know, through his adoption by Henry Axum, this invader and pastoralist. So I was very, very interested in that particular kind of relationship.
I mean, like the one point he's even... that he's offered to join the police force because he can play the police force cricket team. Okay, I did say earlier that we're going to have questions, so please get those ready. I'm just going to ask one more question to each of you, and we talked about this before we came on. Part of my motivation to have Fiona and Paul here was not to address the issue who can write for who or who should write for who, but to actually address the issue of the books you are writing, which is very different. In other words, to say, I want to have a conversation about how you approach these books. So if we're thinking about an atmosphere or a climate where that question hovers, as non-Aboriginal authors, you're both writing books where these are, in some ways, and I'm using the term more broadly, in a frontier context, in which relationships between non-Aboriginal and Aboriginal people are central, obvious. How do you approach that in the sense of considerations, and I'm speculating, of the responsibilities of that, of the challenges of that, and I suppose of the enjoyment of that, because ultimately I don't think you'd be writing these books if you didn't value and enjoy what you're doing. So how would you as authors respond to how you're dealing with this material and maybe what I might call it in the sort of current atmosphere about these sort of wider discussions? So, anyone?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, with enormous consideration and caution for starters. But for me, I had been writing in the broad space of black and white history for a long time in my nonfiction, and as a novelist, I, you know, was thinking for a long time about what I was going to do next, and it felt to me like almost an abrogation of responsibility were I not to to do a novel in this space. Also, you know, I have a number of Aboriginal friends and Torres Strait Islanders who write, and every year things would come up, like around about Australia Day every year, one of them in particular would say to me, I'm just so over writing about this and explaining to non-Indigenous people, readers, why it is that that this date irks me so much and why it is so uncomfortable. So I see this as shared history, and I see it as a white writer as a responsibility to go there and to write fiction there. But that said, there were massive considerations about how I would write Aboriginal characters, and it took me a long time to settle on the method. And for me, it was about voice, and it's why I used two first-person voices of white men. So they, the black characters, are observed through their eyes, but I don't inhabit them at any point, and because I don't feel, as a white privileged man, I'm able or capable of doing that. That said, I think it's still possible for me to write them. I don't know if that helps, Tony.
I wasn't looking for help. It's, no, I'm really interested because I talked about this outside. Alexis Wright, a great friend of mine who people, of course, will know, has a seminal essay, What Happens When You Tell Someone Else's Story. And anyone who hasn't read the essay but loves the headline is mistaken. It's not a essay about censorship or any way. It's an essay about responsibility. Mm. So what Alexis Wright is asking any writer writing on it is, you know, what are your responsibilities and what care do you take to your work? What ethics do you take to your work? And when I taught creative writing at Melbourne University, the first question I asked students, oh, what's your ethical commandment or statement? And no one had one, which, you know, what 18-year-old has an ethical statement about anything? But anything, no, I'm joking. but to get writers to think about the ethics of writing, the privilege, and I'm using privilege in a positive, the absolute privilege of publishing writing comes with, I think, a welcome responsibility. So I do like your response, Fiona.
I mean, I think one of the things that makes us perfect partners for this event is that both of our books are in part about this question exactly, who gets to tell these stories, who gets to write the history, who gets to create the art, and what is the, you know, what's the responsibility, what are the obligations, what are the various ways that we might wrestle with these large questions. I mean, my novel is in so many ways in conversation with Australian literature and the way in which it has chosen to represent the frontier violence and the relation between First Nations and European settlers. It is full of, and one of the reasons that the novel has so many characters in it, and this is really similar again to Paul, and that sense of wanting there to be more than one voice. So it was really important to me when I realized that I was writing a novel set in the late 19th century, that it never claimed to be an authoritative voice that was going to tell you exactly what it looked like and felt like to live in 1883 South Australia. I wanted the book to be noisy and argumentative and full of contradictions and full of people with really different understandings and expectations of what it meant to be in a human body in this particular place at this particular time. But then, of course, this question of you know, how, I mean, representation is in itself a huge privilege, and it is something we have to think about sort of ethically. And that question of how do we acknowledge the enormous weight that has come with white representation of Australian culture and history? How do we acknowledge that while not necessarily, while trying not to add to that weight? So we acknowledge that it's there. And sort of poke at it. The very worst person in my novel is a white Australian writer, and that is me. he's a policeman, really deliberately, because I'm really interested in thinking about how voices of all kinds have been policed by Australian literature and culture and history, just as Paul's book is really interested in that. So the novel is full of... It's full of, I mentioned artists behaving badly. It's full of questions about who gets to tell a story and at what cost and at what damage, you know, what damage that causes. But then in terms of my own personal responsibility, I think it's coming into this with a huge sense of just great humility. I also teach creative writing, and we talk a lot about, do you write what you know? Can you write outside what you know? And I like to talk with my students about understand knowing what you don't know, understanding that you're stepping into something that is beyond you, that you don't know it, and sort of submitting yourself, I suppose, to that process, gratefully calling upon assistance, doing the hard yards in person and in archives, and never trying to pretend that you are in any way an authority who is sort of wading in and saying, I have the answer to this question.
Thank you. Okay, so who's got the first question? Oh, that was quick. It was like a trigger finger. Now, There you go, and then we'll come over here.
Okay, thanks. This is sort of a follow-on to what we're just talking about, because I'm really interested in the idea of place in both your novels and it being, you know, place and country being this, use the word, like hostile and sinister, and whether there was a process during the writing of both of your novels where you had to kind of, you know, not reckon with, but... where you had to, I guess, maybe address or, you know, yeah, look into your places in from a settler colonial context and what it means to be, I guess, a writer writing about these issues and whether your idea or your relationship with country and place shifted over that process, I guess.
Over decades, I've spent a lot of time in different Indigenous communities and on country with different Aboriginal people. So it's something I thought about all the time. I actually started this book, writing this book, 6 or 7 years ago, in one of those communities, which is very remote, and where I go occasionally for headspace, and I felt like I wanted to start writing it there, having thought about it a lot. Yeah, of course, I always think when I'm in those places about how privileged I am and how enormously sort of beneficial it is as a human being to get that space and to do something, for example, like go fishing with the people that live there. And it's all instructive for all of my work.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. No, sorry, I was pointing behind your back. So.
I mean, for me, one of the things that really marked writing this book, I mean, I started this novel... I was at Adelaide Writers Festival with my first novel. I went to the Flinders for the first time and had an immediate response to place and started thinking about the book from that point. But I finished the book living in California during pandemic lockdown. I moved to California and then the pandemic struck almost immediately. And we were in lockdown for 18 months and I know Melbourne knows all about lockdowns. California was kind of like Melbourne. And I finished the book in that time. And it was an interesting, strange, I don't know, a kind of life-giving experience to think about place and think about writing place from a place that's so utterly unlike the Flinders. I'm not sure yet how that, or if that did change my relationship with place, but there is something... There was something, I think, about the borders being closed and not being able to come home that forced me to think about all kinds of things, including the privileged situation that I have spent my entire life in which those borders have always been open to me in ways that feel unproblematic, as if I deserve to cross those borders whenever I want to. And that was definitely something that was on my mind as I wrote about home from California. Yeah.
So we have another question over here, and then I'm going to have to wind up.
Is it on? Yes. Fiona, I wondered, in terms of your writing, well, you live in Berkeley, is that right? And First Nations experiences, the different location contour what you're doing. And I wondered at the reception of your work in that context versus the reception perhaps in Australia and elsewhere. And it reminded me of Beryl Gilroy saying she had her whiteness to take her wherever she wanted to go, of Jean Rhys. And so could you talk about what you envisage the different reception of your work might be filtered through by virtue of those different locations?
Sure, thank you. What a wonderful question, and one that I'm still kind of grappling with. It's interesting to talk about the book in the US because I feel as if there are enormous I mean, there's all this education that has to come along with it because US readers, they know very, very little about the context that I'm talking about. And I was interested by one review in the Washington Post or something like that that claimed that my novel was entirely without an ideological agenda. And I thought, I think only an American could say that because you know, there is perhaps a sense in which that particular reader didn't understand all of the ways in which an Australian would read this book and very clearly, I think, see what my ideological agenda was. Again, coming back to that question of the ethics of writing and why we do it and who does it and what responsibilities we have, etc. So, you know, I think just in a broader sense, it has also been interesting to think about the relationship between, say, the University of California, Berkeley, and the Ohlone land that it stands on, and the ways in which California, at least, I can't speak for all of America, has a very different and perhaps more, I don't know, subterranean relationship with First Nations dispossession. So there is, there's a sort of, I'm not quite sure yet how I feel about it. But one thing I'll say just really quickly is that every single interview I've done in Australia or event has asked me about this question of representation and who, you know, about having Aboriginal characters and dealing with this issue. Every single one has, and I appreciate it enormously. And not a single American interviewer has asked.
Thank you, Fiona. That also reminds me of a comment on this, going back to Alexis Wright's essay, which is so important, is that your statement then, Fiona, about appreciating that question is to make the point that as writers, we should appreciate the question asked of us about our responsibilities, and even if it comes with mild interrogation, or we have to accept that. So as an Aboriginal writer, we cop more flack off blackfellas than you think. Yeah, whitefellas think, oh, it's hard for us to write about Aboriginal people. If you're an Aboriginal, yeah, when I wrote The White Girl, all Aboriginal artists saying, you got it right, that's the best you'll get off them. And if you get it wrong, you're in massive trouble. And another point is that the audiences, I did an event, so my novel The White Girl was released in the US through Harper Veer, and I did an event for World Indigenous Peoples Day with the Brooklyn Library, and it seemed to be going fine, and then question time came, and the first question was, Tony, Kamala Harris, is she actually black or not?
Oh, wow.
Seriously. Okay, I really want to thank Paul and Fiona. I was looking forward so much to this conversation, and I think you've got a great sense of what their books are about. As I said at the outset, both Paul and Fiona will be available for signings and conversation over here at the Readings Booksellers. I've really appreciated it, so could people please thank...
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.